Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, Debt and the Dinner Table. Navigating those conversations with family can be difficult, especially if you don't know where to start. Leslie Ann Skorke is a financial expert and founder of MeVest. She's here to share her tips. Then, some Canadian households are more vulnerable than others during these really uncertain financial times. The Financial Resilience Institute is looking to help improve the financial resilience and the well-being of these households in particular. Eloise Duncan is the founder and CEO of the Institute. She is here to tell us all about it and why deferring CPP until age 70 might not be the best idea right now. Fred Vitesse is former chief actuary of Morneau Chappell. He's the author of Retirement Income for Life, and he's here to talk about why he feels a little bit differently about this strategy than he has in the past. Plus, the financial challenges sex workers face. Maggie McDonald joins us to talk about gig work plus stigma and how that makes it so difficult for them when it comes to managing their money. And I'll speak with financial coach Aquanya Askarne about the purpose of money and her tips for building generational wealth. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started. Resilience. The dictionary defines it as the capacity to recover quickly from difficulties. And it is a trait that, as a parent, I want to foster in my child. And it is a trait that, as a culture, we want to foster in Canadians, especially when it comes to finances. However, it is more than a trait. It takes more than cheerleading, more than training to enable financial resilience, because the pressures and the burdens and the complexities are immense. The Financial Resilience Institute looks to improve the resilience and well-being, the financial resilience and well-being of Canadians. And Eloise Duncan is its founder and CEO. She joins us today from Vancouver, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
How do you define financial resilience?
So financial resilience is about your ability to get through financial hardships, stresses, or shocks as a result of unplanned life events. And we measure this for Canadians at the national, provincial, and individual level through the CMOR Financial Resilience Index across 9 indicators.
Why do we need an institute? That's kind of a leading question, because of course there's always more work to be done. But why an institute?
Great question, Bruce. So did you know that 78% of Canadians, representing just under 20 million people, are financially vulnerable, with financial vulnerability evident for people across all household income demographics? We created the Institute because, as a not-for-profit, to help reduce the problem of financial vulnerability across Canada, leveraging our index analytics and expert team. So what we're doing is we're partnering with financial institutions, business leaders, and policymakers to develop and implement solutions that improve financial resilience, health, and well-being for all.
One of the things that I find fascinating about the index is the drivers of financial resilience. There are three that really caught my attention: social capital, liquid savings, and credit score. What do you mean about the first? What do you mean by social capital?
Social capital is whether you have a close family member or friend who you're willing to turn to for financial support in terms of financial hardship. So what we find in Canada is that there's a large proportion of people that don't have anyone they can turn to for help. Mm-hmm. There are others that have people they could turn to but won't, and then people who will have them and they would turn to them. And that's one of the unique indicators within our index.
I began by articulating the definition of the word resilience. In the financial context, though, it is about so much more than a trait, because there are many, many, many circumstances that has certain populations be less resilient, not because they don't have the trait, not that they're not trying, but because of, as I say, the circumstances that they face. What would be some of the ones that you would highlight and that would help magnify the distinction here between just pick up your socks and rank up those bootstraps and soldier on?
We do see from the index that people who exhibit healthy financial behaviors, such as regularly saving, do have improved financial resilience. But we also see very clearly from the index that there are people who are facing systemic barriers impacting their ability to work, for example, which again can cause challenges for them. So there are many nuances by household, and that's what the index shines a light on for organizations wanting to see how they can improve the financial resilience of their specific customers and communities over time.
What are the biggest public policy levers that you believe will increase the level of financial resilience in this country?
I'm not a policy expert, but I do see opportunities for policymakers to think about different policies that would help to improve, for in particular, the financial security and financial resilience of Canadians that are most financially vulnerable based on the index. We also see opportunities for improved consumer protection and advocacy, and for policymakers and financial institutions work with the across the ecosystem to do more to help those who need help most.
I get pitched surveys all the time. They are not statistically significant. They're marketing surveys. And so I am inherently skeptical to these headline grabbing notes that talk about, you know, people's concern about their finances as sponsored by insert brand here. The Financial Resilience Index is not that. You've got the data integrity and you've been looking at this thing over time, at this question over time. What are some things that you have learned have been shifting?
You're right. The index does build on 6 years of longitudinal financial well-being studies data for Canada. So it's incredibly robust. And we are the leading independent authority on financial health in Canada. So to answer your question, I mean, we see a lot of things shifting as pre-pandemic and then post-pandemic. We've seen liquid savings buffers. They're now at all-time lows as Canadians are having to spend more or the same as their income to bridge through given the inflationary environment. So before the pandemic hit, we were seeing financial vulnerability is a mainstream issue, which is why we created the index. But what we're seeing now is despite people working very hard from a behavioral perspective, with increased interest rates and the inflationary environment and other challenges, it's increasingly difficult for many households to bridge through. And we're seeing increased inequities with more financially vulnerable populations being more challenged than ever.
I'm going to ask you one last question here, and it is this. What do you want our listeners to do with this insight? We know that our population is not as resilient from a financial perspective as they could be. We know that circumstances remain very, very tough for millions of people in this country. What would you like our listeners to do?
I mean, I think our work and the index provides a call to action to consumers to learn more about their financial resilience and how they can improve it. We see from our data that 73% of Canadians want to understand their financial resilience and how they can improve it. But just as importantly, this is really a call to action to financial institutions, policymakers, not-for-profits and the wider ecosystem to do more to lever their assets to help their customers and communities that need it most. Mm-hmm. And what we see from our data is that there's a lot of room for improvement on that front.
Eloise, briefly, where can people find out more about the report itself?
So on our website is our latest report. All of our reports are free for the ecosystem. And the URL is www.finresilienceinstitute.org.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Eloise Duncan is the founder and CEO of the Financial Resilience Institute.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple,
with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks,
Sirius XM 167.
Fred Vitese is the former chief actuary of Morneau Chappell and the author of Retirement Income for Life. He's joined us on this show a number of times in the past, and in one interview, he shared his advice on why he believed it was a really good idea to defer CPP until age 70. But now, Fred says that may no longer be the best option for folks, and he joins us now to tell us why. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. It's great to be back.
So I have really locked on to this advice that you shared with us around the time that Retirement Income for Life came out, when it was published. What was the rationale then? Before we talk about what you think has changed, what was the rationale then for delaying CPP until 70?
First of all, let me say I feel a bit sheepish because I've been probably the biggest proponent in Canada for delaying CPP until age 70. Mm. And so the reason why I've always told people to delay until 70 is that you end up getting an actuarial adjustment. They actually boost your CPP pension by 8.4% per year. So 5 years of that. And it's about 42% higher at 70 than it is at 65. I say about, and we can get into the details as to why it's not exactly that, but it's about 42% higher. And when you do the math, when we actuaries do the math, the present value of that pension is number one, a lot greater, but not a lot greater. It's greater, maybe by about 10% than starting it at age 65. But the other thing is now, especially with inflation becoming a factor again, is that it just gives you more inflation protected pension for the rest of your life. And that's what we want to do now. We want to be maximizing that.
So all that said, you're saying it may not be the best option to defer. How come?
And that's where I get sheepish. So I've always told people to wait until 70. And this isn't everybody. So there's a couple of groups who shouldn't be waiting until 70. These would be people who for some reason have a shortened life expectancy. That would be one group. Another group would be people who just don't have the assets to wait until age 70. Let's say you retire at 64. You have to live on something. And if you don't have enough assets in your RIF or your RSP to draw down until 70, then you just can't do it. So some people can't do it. But for everybody else, I think it's still a majority of Canadians, it still makes sense. So to wait until about 70. So here's what happened. 2022, well, everything involving COVID has been unusual. So 2022 was one of the years which has been greatly affected by COVID. And the biggest impact has been on inflation. So there's different measures of inflation. We've seen headline numbers of around 8%, 8.5%. For CPP purposes, they use the period from October, so November to October, 12-month average. And based on that, we don't know for sure yet. It looks like the increase coming January the 1st, 2023, is going to be 6.4%, give or take. And so that's why it makes sense to take it a little earlier. Because so let's say you start your pension on December the 1st, 2022, instead of starting it, say, in April 2023. So 5 months early. You're not getting the full actuarial adjustment I mentioned to get up to 42%, but you're close to it. The big thing is you're getting that 6.4% increase in the pension you started in December, just 1 month later in January. So they start paying you 6.4% more the very next month. And when I've done the math on that, I find that it's a total no-brainer. You end up getting more pension for life, as a matter of fact, with one exception, and I'll get to that. But you also get a much higher present value of pension, even if it wasn't more pension. But so you get an extra 4 months or 5 months worth that compared to starting it in May of next year. Now, this trick, if you want to call it that, it's like one of these YouTube hacks. It works best if you were going to be starting your pension in the first 6 months of 2023 anyway. It works best if you're really close to 70. It doesn't work that well at all if you're under 65. Doesn't work that well if you're starting your pension, if your birth date is, say, October, November, and that was when you were going to start your pension, and now you're taking it 10 months early. So that's when it works the best, and it works great under the conditions I mentioned. First 6 months of the year, and you were going to be turning 70 anyway.
Now, when we think about this, when do I take CPP? Should it be 70? Should it be 65? Is it shades of the, or is it binary? As in, if it's 65, it's one scenario. If it's 70, it's a different scenario. Or is it 65, 66, 67, 68? Is it shades of gray?
These are shades of gray, and sometimes the best shade is not totally black or totally white. Mm. So I found this in my book, Retirement Income for Life, in my second edition. I actually introduced those nuances, and I found that for some people, the ideal age to wait until is like 68 instead of 70 or 65. Now, it might be worth a little more at 70, but they can't quite wait until that long, because then they can't get the right shape of income curve. And I know now I'm getting kind of technical. Mm. Well, all to say that sometimes you don't want to start it at 65 or 70, but somewhere in the middle.
One of the reasons I love our conversations is that as an actuary, you really are grounded in the math and the mortality tables and all those sorts of things. What would you say to someone who just has this view of their life that they aren't going to live into their 80s or 90s, so they may as well start getting that CPP now? How do you connect their feeling of longevity versus what the math says?
Well, I would tell them, first of all, that most people feel that way, that they put a disproportionate amount of probability on the prospect of dying young. So they really have to, I guess, explore the reasons why they might feel that way. There are very few rare diseases where people, I actually do know that they're going to probably die young. But for the vast majority of us, that really isn't the case. They also have to look at the regret factor. There's two possible scenarios here. One is that you stretch your CPP at age 70, and then you die young. You die at, say, 72, and you didn't only collect it for 2 years, and then there's the regret of only having left some money on the table. That regret is somewhat muted by the fact that you're dead, so you really aren't
muted.
There to regret anyway.
I think it's pretty well muted by the fact your spouse might not be super happy about it, but you're dead.
Yeah. Okay, so the other way, though, let's say you started at age 65, and then you end up living until 94 after all. And then, of course, the regret there is much more real and probably starts to kick in around age 82.
There is a real level of engagement with the numbers that is super relevant for someone who's in their 60s, because they're making this choice. You know, they're like, oh, is it going to be 65? Is it going to be 66? Is it going to be whatever? For those of us who are well away from that age, and I'm in that category, can we still start with the hypothesis that that CPP at 70 should be the starting point?
CPP at 70 should definitely be the starting point. And all I found, I guess, is this one little wrinkle, is that if inflation is high in the year before you turn 70, then you may want to start thinking about starting your pension in December 1st of the year before you turn 70. That would be about the only wrinkle I can really tell. I'm not giving people carte blanche to start their pensions at 60 or 65 or whatever. There's really no other reason to start early apart from the one very important wrinkle that I did find.
Very, very helpful stuff. Fred, thank you for your time. We really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Fred Vitese is former chief actuary of Morneau Chappell. He is the author of Retirement Income for Life. And we were talking about the CPP start date, whether you should wait till 70, if you can afford it. And if you don't have, you know, a clarity on your longevity, there are some nuances in this current time. Coming up next on Moolala, the steps you can take when a family member asks you for help with their debt. Financial expert Leslie Ann Scorgi will take us through some of the different scenarios and what you might say. And later, I'll speak to Aquanya Escarne about the purpose of money and tips for building generational wealth. For more Moolala, you can head on over to moolala.ca. You can listen to past episodes, and you can search by guest name. You can search by guest topic. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms. We're on Spotify and Stitcher and Amazon Prime and all that stuff. While you're there, subscribe, maybe even review the show.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolala, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. I am of the view that you can talk about anything, nothing is off limits. But my opinion hits the stress test when it comes to talking about debt with your family. It can be difficult knowing how to have these conversations with your loved ones and how to support them in a way that works for them and works for you. Leslie Ann Scorgi is personal finance expert, Toronto Star columnist, founder of MeVest. She joins us now to share some of her tips. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. What a huge subject, talking to family about debt or money, anything. It's like the taboo subjects we should always stay away from.
It is.
Money,
but instead,
religion.
You and I just leap right in. We just, just go to the table and pull up a chair. We just and pull up a chair. So you recently wrote about this topic in your column in the Toronto Star. What do you think makes the topic of debt so fraught with families?
Right now, like it has, I think this subject has elevated because there's so much pressure in the market. We're entering a recession, rates are rising. So if you have debt, that means you are paying more right now. And I think if we go back in time and we look at what is okay to talk about in families, money's never really been there on the subject list, but it's extra fraught right now because there's so much pressure. And let's face it, when you are seeing a family member struggle with debt, it's hard to watch. It's loaded with emotion. And if you're like me, who is like, you know, I have to always watch myself because I'm full of advice, yes. You really have to hold back here and figure out a way to connect with a family member who might be struggling with debt in an appropriate way. Without making yourself and others feel totally horrible about the conversation.
Yes, you say tone is everything. Tone is everything. What do you mean?
So really, at the end of the day, a family member who's struggling with debt, they need to know that debt is a fixable situation. Mm-hmm. What they're really looking for is probably not a bailout. What they probably need is your love, your support, your guidance, maybe even the influence of a positive money mindset. Mm-hmm. That is what will hopefully spark positive financial change for them. So again, like there are professionals who actually do the work around debt. They are the ones who are really responsible for teaching new systems and the, you know, worst cases, putting together, consolidation loans and consumer proposals. But what a family member's role here is support. That's the first most important thing here.
Yeah. A lot of listeners may say, it is none of my business. At what point do you believe it is a family member's business to at least open the door to a conversation?
So I think this is where the conversation happens. Someone is confiding in you about their debt, and then they ask for your help. So confiding is different from asking for help. If they're confiding in you, you may as a family member want to be really explicit with them and say, are you wanting my help? And if they say, no thanks, back off. It's about respect. But if they give you the all clear, they say, you know what? I think I do need some help. There are ways to start going down that path. And the first starting point is really understanding what they're dealing with. So is it credit card balances? Have collection agencies started to phone? What is going on? And it can be really helpful if they've opened the door to share even personal experiences. You may even share your own financial mistakes to help like establish common ground that they are not alone and that they can move through this.
You mentioned that most family members are not asking for a bailout, but some probably are, and they may not be explicit about it, but that's in the background. What's your wisdom for whether a family member should take that action?
I have to tell you, I've been coaching and counseling people on money matters for like 16 plus years. And to date, I have not seen a totally successful bailout. And I've seen lots. And here's what happens is a bailout without dealing with the underlying reasons for how the debt happened in the first place will lead to another one. It's because when you are looking at equipping somebody who's dealing with debt with better skills, that is that's in the life skill toolbox, and it requires a different strategy, not just a bailout. So it's like, if you want to help and you feel compelled to do the bailout, I have to say, you must pair this with good quality learning for the person who is dealing with the debt. So I'm going to give you an example. Imagine you are a parent, you're watching your child who's an adult who has their own family struggle, and you want to help. So you offer them the money. Make sure that you also offer them counseling support for debt, and possibly even some, you know, financial coaching or money coaching off to the side, because it's not enough to just bail them out. Statistics, unfortunately, show that doesn't work.
Now, when we think about any area of life that a family member could be dealing with, addictions, mental health, you know, marital strife, all those sorts of things, we as individuals need to think about how proactive are we going to be? And I appreciate your point off the top that this is something that, you know, they could come to you to talk about. At what point do you go to them and sort of, you know, I'm not talking about necessarily something as specific as a quote intervention, but something in that world where they're not actually a request, I'm not saying they want to talk about it, and you still decide, I'm going there?
I'd say if there is a compromise to health, if there are children involved, and if you're watching basically the train wreck about to happen, and people's lives are going to be impacted, I'd say that's when you step in, especially if there's children involved. Yeah, you do have to step in and ask if there is, you know, if you can get the all clear to help out. And, you know, I think it's such a sensitive area, but I want to go back to a point I made just a minute ago, a couple of minutes ago, which is, when you are offering help, it doesn't mean necessarily a bailout. It could be that the family member you're dealing with, like the chances are, is they don't know what to do next. So you could be the bridge to help them understand what could be a next step. So here's an example. Let's say you are watching your family member. They are basically close to bankruptcy. Whether they've confided in you or not, it's clear to you that they're very close to bankruptcy. You could step in and give them the names and numbers of local licensed insolvency trustees, and those, you know, if the family member is open to it, they can go ahead, reach out, and maybe begin to explore a consumer proposal. That's the step before bankruptcy. Now, in that scenario, you're basically the bridge to the professional help. And that might feel a lot better for the person receiving the help than you know, judging or getting in there and trying to tell them what to do. Do you know what I mean?
Nobody likes to be told what to do.
It's an instinct in myself that I need to restrain.
Right. And like another scenario here is you may, maybe you're living really close with that family member down the street. Maybe they're in your house because let's face it, I've seen this scenario many, many times where the debt is so extreme that the person who is indebted has to move back in with the family. Mm-hmm. And in that case, the debt's high, but maybe it's being managed. So that person might benefit from the services of a credit counseling agency.
Yeah.
And that again is like for you to act as a bridge, get the names and numbers of a credit counseling agency and then hand it over, hand the case off.
Yeah.
So that like you are not actually dealing up the tips yourself.
Credit Canada, one of those nonprofit credit counselors, the key thing that I would say is as you do your internet search, be sure to include the phrase nonprofit credit counselors. And nonprofit credit counselors can set up debt consolidation programs. They can also make referrals to licensed insolvency trustees, depending on the circumstances. What is your call to action, Leslie Ann, here? If you're in a family in which you're sneaking suspicion is that there is an issue, what's your call to action? What should people do?
I think kindness, you approach with kindness, whether you are being confided in or you see it and you've got good judgment and you know this is happening, approach carefully, approach with kindness, be that helpful person, but ask where you need, ask the person, like, where should we draw the line here? Like I've said before, like you are unlikely to fix the problem through a bailout or by telling them what to do. The key here is to create a path forward, help get that person moving. And, you know, they will learn techniques like the snowball method of reducing debt. They will learn all of this if you are setting up good boundaries and you know which pros to bring in. Mm. So just tread lightly and be gentle. Here's the other thing is like the whole family does not want this person to go and splurge, right? Like they want you to be in better financial health. So I think some of this is also family expectations that can be really helpful. My advice here is be loving, be supportive, and watch where you're treading so that you're welcome.
Okay, fine. I'll take that to heart. Leslie Ann, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Bruce.
Leslie Ann Scorgi is a personal finance expert. She is also the founder of MeVest. She had more to say on this topic in a recent column in the Toronto Star.
Hi, it's me, your dad. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, the purpose of money. We'll talk to Aquanya Escarne about her tips on how to discover it for yourself. But first, the financial discrimination faced by sex workers. Maggie McDonald will be here. And stay up to date on Moolala by signing up for our newsletter. It includes all the fun things that I have done on this show, at least fun for me. I don't know, fun for you too. CBC Radio, CityLine, SiriusXM, BNN, Bloomberg, all that stuff.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
On this show, we talk about all aspects of money, all aspects, and for people in all sorts of different circumstances. And we endeavor to do that without judgment. Now, for some of you, this next conversation might push your judgy button. We're going to talk about the financial challenges faced by sex workers. Their situation is as precarious as any gig worker out there, but with the burden of stigma added on top. Maggie McDonald is a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto. She wrote a piece for The Walrus about the routine financial discrimination that these precarious workers face. And she's here to talk about some of those challenges and some of the solutions. Hello, Maggie.
Hi, Bruce.
If we can park our morality at the door, so whatever opinion you have, park that at the door, how do you, as a researcher, how do you think about sex work and sex workers?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I start from a position of sex work is work. There are a lot of jobs that I might not find savory. It doesn't make them any less of a job.
Right. What are some of the misconceptions that you think people have about people who do this work?
Well, that it overrides their entire lives. I don't think anyone necessarily likes to be thought of as being purely a vessel for their job, but that is definitely a condition that sex workers face frequently.
What are some of the examples of financial discrimination that you would highlight?
For sure. Well, in my conversations with sex workers, one that comes up a lot is Airbnb. There are refusals to accept transactions from sex workers. They are booted from the platform under suspicion of being sex workers, whether or not the rental and the terms of the rental have anything to do with a job, I will say. If a sex worker has ever been flagged as doing porn or having worked in sex work, it becomes impossible to rent a vacation rental on your actual vacation.
Chargebacks are something that the credit card companies deal with and is has a very real impact on their bottom line. Tell us about what the credit card company's concern is and how that affects people who earn their money with subscriptions or with whatever it is that they earn their money from.
Yeah, so chargebacks occur when a customer challenges a charge on their credit card. And the charge has to be reversed. And it's a process that cumulatively costs these financial processors a lot of money. Of course, sex workers are told quite frequently that they are not viable clients for certain services and products from financial companies, credit cards among them. And one of the standard fallbacks is that there are a disproportionate level of chargebacks that these clients are incurring. However, there are never any numbers left to accompany that. And there are many industries that do access the same suite of services who have equally high chargeback risks, like travel agencies, casinos and gambling in general, but none suffer the same kind of scrutiny, surveillance, vitriol that sex workers do.
Right.
It's more of a reputational clause, but it's such a gray area, it's hard to enforce.
And a chargeback would be someone has a charge connected to, say, a porn site or something. They call the credit card company and say, that wasn't me, knowing full well that it was. They just don't want it appearing on their statement.
Absolutely. Or at least that's the premise that, you know, we'll hear from financial institutions and banks, that it happens disproportionately often.
Now, this isn't simple in looking at it through the lens of financial services companies. When Pornhub was hit with a host of allegations about underage content, the credit card companies, and there was a groundswell of support for this move, they reacted, and it seemed like they were trying to be helpful. What is the nuance here that a simple read of those stories would not provide?
Absolutely. The context is everything, because one of the reasons that this has been a perpetual problem for sex workers is that it's a very low-hanging political fruit to say that you are anti-sex work, working to abolish sex work, anti-pornography. It wins very easy populist points. So politicians and lawmakers are very quick to say that they are doing something about it. Now, something that gets lost in the context of the child pornography Pornhub scandal is that they were being targeted as a company. MindGeek, the parent company of Pornhub, was being targeted as uniquely a perpetrator of child pornography. When in fact, even in the original article that broke the story, there in the New York Times by Nicholas Kristof, there was an admission that Facebook reported an exponentially higher amount of child pornography being posted to their sites. They're moderating it, of course, but it's not a problem unique to pornography. In fact, it's in the interests of professional pornographers whose bottom line depends on running a clean business under a very, you know, a world full of scrutiny, to adhere to Canada's extremely tight record keeping obligations. We have some of the world's tightest record keeping obligations when it comes to proof of age and documentation for pornography that's being sold commercially.
How about from a tax perspective? So I know I have had an Airbnb property. I make sure that I report that income. You know, lots of people earn money through online means. They hopefully report that income and pay tax on it. Does that work any differently for sex workers?
No, I mean, sex workers report income. It's hard to paint them with a single brush because they are effectively contractors. There's many different ways to engage in sex work. So some, you know, I'm sure are not reporting income. Some, it is highly standardized and they receive a T4.
Your work as an academic looks at your, broadly speaking, within the realm of communication, you look at technology in a very deep way. What are some of the ways in which the system, the technology, the policy could be improved to reduce discrimination against people who do this type of work?
I will die on the hill that is, sex workers need to be invited to the consultation processes around these decision-making practices. Mm. We have a horrific track record here in Canada, but also globally, of excluding the people who this kind of governance concerns from conversations about it. So in any other field, that would be immediately recognized as ludicrous, but there has been decades now of successful anti-pornography campaigning by conservative evangelical religious groups, mostly American, who actually do have quite a great amount of lobbying power and a great amount of sway within political circles, especially in the United States, but there's that, you know, cultural bleed over into Canada. So namely, there's groups like the Trafficking Hub campaign, it's led up by Layla McKilwaite. And like these people used to campaign against, you know, gay characters in Disney films and how witchcraft on television, Harry Potter shouldn't exist. They're deeply anti-trans, but a very clean Trojan horse for them to use is that they are anti-pornography, that they are protecting children. And they have a huge amount of sway with financial firms, with big banks, with credit card companies, because they have a massive populist following.
Technology has made it simpler in many ways to match client and service provider in this realm, but also it seems like simpler and more difficult to transact for the sex workers themselves. Give us a sense for how technology has changed the game.
Absolutely. It's surveillance, which is something that we are all susceptible to. But when there is a class of workers, like sex workers, who are considered uniquely risky, quote unquote, uniquely a detriment to, you know, brand management and PR by these major financial firms, they want to create such a visible level of distance between themselves and these demographics that this is the case that I make, that you see these sort of implicit discriminatory policies from the big banks, from credit card firms, from you know, the platforms that are supposedly paying these sex workers in the first place. They often struggle to find methods to pay these sex workers because many companies preclude them from being allowed to be clients. Mm.
In addition to including sex workers in the consultation, what other key actions could be taken to reducing the discrimination against this particular demographic?
I touched on this very briefly in my most recent piece with The Walrus, but sex work is so widely stigmatized that I believe that they should be included in protected classes of citizenry under discrimination laws in Canada, and they currently are not.
Hmm. That's a pretty profound and key thing. Why do you think that would help?
Well, because, you know, we're seeing both violence against women, queer people, trans people, the demographics that are most predominant in the people who do sex work. We see huge amounts of violence against them, institutional violence. Like there's a long and storied history of police violence. There's a long and storied history of harassment from colleagues. Should you ever try and get out of doing sex work or pornography? You know, there have been so many headlines about paramedics who lose their jobs because they used to have an OnlyFans. You know, parents whose children are pulled from school because the single mother of children is trying to make ends meet on OnlyFans. You see this frequently. There's all these different forms of discrimination. And then in this case, this financial piece, these massive technology firms, they really hide behind a smoke screen of saying everything is automated. Everything is algorithmic. Everything is, it must be fair because it's based in data. But the thing about data is data tells a story, and data is based in data sets that are discriminatory. You know, there's countless examples of like how algorithms can reinforce racist practices or misogynist practices, and they definitely disenfranchise sex workers. I think that the fact that our courts have determined that this form of sex work, pornography work, is completely legal, it's compatible with the law. We as a democratic collective have decided this. It is a very dangerous precedent to allow private financial firms to decide otherwise. Because if we allow that kind of precedent to stand, who's next?
Interesting stuff. Maggie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bruce. Always
Maggie,
a pleasure.
Maggie McDonald is a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto, and she joined us to talk about the financial challenges faced by sex workers. Coming up next, financial coach Akwanya Askarne talks about the purpose of money. If you have a question or a comment about the show so far, our email address is ask@moolala.ca. I am also the money columnist for a TV show called City Line, a daily lifestyle show, food, fashion, the whole thing. Our segments at cityline.tv. Moolala is sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. The funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
I have been talking about the purpose of money for, like, I'm going to say 15 years, for a really, really long time. It is the foundational concept of both of my books, and I think it is, hands down, the most important thing you need to get super clear on to get a handle on your money. So it makes me extra excited to introduce our next guest. Akwanya Askarne is a financial coach and founder of The Purpose of Money. She joins us now to talk about that and her tips for building wealth. She is in Aldi, Virginia. Hello there.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me today. This is great.
Well, I'm so glad that, but see, I'm even interrupting you already because I'm so excited to talk about The Purpose of Money. What do you mean when you use the phrase the purpose of money?
That's a great question. So I named my platform The Purpose of Money because I wanted to help women specifically define that for themselves. In my case, my purpose for money is leaving a legacy and building generational wealth for my family. I have two small boys and a husband, and I do everything for them. But for my clients who I work with, I help them define their why on their own. Some people, it is the ability to create freedom and not work as much. For others, it's to create something they can leave behind. Mm-hmm. So everyone's purpose for money is different, but mine specifically was to the ability to be able to leave a legacy, live a life of freedom, and travel as much as possible.
And mine is adventure. The purpose of my money is adventure. And I do all the stupid, boring, horrendous tasks you need to do to get a handle on your money in service of adventure. And yet when I talk about this, I use a different word. I talk about context. But if we talk about the purpose of money, in the absence of this broader kind of meaning, what people will say is the rent, my credit card. The purpose of money is to pay my bills. How do you take them on this journey from a very literal interpretation of the purpose of money, like you're laying bills down on the counter to pay for food, to what you and I are talking about, legacy, adventure, travel?
I first talk to them about what they want their life to look like. I think when you can envision a life you've always wanted and you focus on that vision, the steps become a little easier for you because you are focused. And one of the things I tell people is, you know, what is that life that you would live if money wasn't an issue? Because we can figure out the money. I have a belief that money is abundant. It can happen and come to me whenever I need it. The question is, am I going to be a good steward of that money once received? So that's where I come in and I say, okay, now that I know your vision, I know when you're trying to retire, what you're trying to do, whether it's travel three times a year instead of zero, or be able to invest more, then we take that and apply it to an actual budget. And we're putting the numbers where we want them to go and seeing if we're able to actually do that. I have some clients who the money is there. They just don't know how to allocate it. No one has ever helped them figure out how to use it. And then I have other clients where the money may not be there. And the reality is you may need to make more money in some cases, but first you have to know where your money's going. So we always start with the vision and then we actually look at the numbers.
You mentioned off the top your commitment to making a difference for women. What are some of the nuances that you see present in female with female clients versus male clients?
Well, the first thing that's not necessarily their fault is the wage gap.
I don't think that's their fault in any way. I can't believe you're being so polite about it. You think we're going to have a discussion to justify the wage gap here?
I'm just saying. Like it makes sense? It exists, and some women don't even realize they're not being equally paid to their counterparts, or they're not properly negotiating for their salary. So I first and foremost work with clients at any stage in their career, but specifically at those major milestones where they can up their price, right? Mm-hmm. I've helped coach clients through how to negotiate a salary increase or a signing bonus or other benefits that would help them get the money that they deserve. But that is the real starting point. That's the reason why I chose this platform and to focus on women, is because we're expected to build wealth. We're normally either the CFO of the household or the only breadwinner of the household. I was raised by a single mom. My dad was in the military most of my childhood, and they were divorced. And I know a lot of moms who are raising children alone and they are the breadwinner, but they're not getting equal pay or they're not getting as much pay. The other issue is we're sometimes the caretaker for our older generations. So then we are also trying to work, we're earning less, and we're caring for additional family members that didn't properly financially plan for themselves. So I find that women are in more likely in a position to have to stretch the same dollar, in addition to the fact that we are mathematically making less. It's been proven. That's why we have equal pay day. That's why we are continuously trying to fight for, you know, equal pay amongst gender for the same work. But I also want people to know that you can still build wealth, even if what you have may not be equal to male counterparts. So that's the thing I've seen the most, is they don't have the salaries that you would want for them at those stages in their career. They come, but they might come later for certain women.
What do you notice about what women want for themselves versus what they want for the collective, be that their family or their community? You talked about doing everything for your kids. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested because certainly it differs by individual. We can't stereotype across gender, but there seems to be, broadly speaking, a more collective view about the purpose of money in a family, in a community, in a world.
I think it depends. I've definitely had women who say, I don't have children, I don't want children, and they still want to build wealth. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that that is justified. I think we all deserve to live the life we want to live. And I do think that women without children or spouses can still leave a legacy. For me, legacy is defined as the impact that you leave on this earth while you're here and beyond your years, right? So when you're gone, how do people remember you? What do they remember you for? And is that what you wanted to be remembered for? And so you can do that with or without children, with or without a family. And sometimes, though, I do see that single women find it harder to define what that legacy is going to be, because we're been taught that you're going to do this for the next generation, you're going to do this for your kids. And they're like, well, I don't have kids, but I still might want a building named after me, or I might want a scholarship that I can help someone go to college, or I might want to help a certain charity. And those are the things that I help women figure out and do, because I'm also a life insurance producer, and life insurance is a great way to leave a legacy. So sometimes for single women, that legacy will be leaving your life insurance to a charity.
If there was one tip or one question you would offer to give people to crack the door for people on this question of what the purpose of money is, what question would you ask? Aside from what's the purpose of money, which is a good question. Well, and maybe that's it.
Well, no, I think the question is what drives you? You know, I don't think everyone's motivated by money. Some people are motivated by vacations. Some people are motivated by experiences. That's me. I love experiences. So you have to ask someone, what is your why? You know, and once you know what your why is, go towards that. That'll drive you, whether it is a financial reason or not. You being passionate about something is half the battle. When you're not passionate, it doesn't happen. So sticking to that focus and making sure that your actions are aligned with that, because I'm a value-based spender. So I may not necessarily care about the name brand cereals and other products in the grocery store. So I'll go cheaper on certain products as long as it's healthy, but I'm going to spend on a luxury vacation. So don't question what and how I spend my free time, because I've said I value vacations. So the same thing would be for you. What do you value most? And are you putting your dollars towards that? Because that's not always the case for some people. And that's the kind of question I ask to get them to really think about, how should I be budgeting my money so that what I'm spending it on is aligned with my values, but also will motivate me to make more money or to do better with my money, because I'm going to get that result, that vacation, that relaxation, that free time, that legacy.
Kwanya, thank you so much for your insight on something you and I are both clearly very passionate about.
Thank you so much.
Kwanya Escarne is a financial coach. She is the founder of The Purpose of Money. She joined us from Aldi, Virginia. That's our show for today. A big thanks to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. You can send us any comments or questions or story ideas or feedback or whatever to that email address. You can also subscribe to our newsletter at the website moolala.ca. And subscribe to the podcast too on any of the podcast platforms and leave us a review. On social media, I am at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you for listening and have a great day.